The Second Coming of Buddy Holly by Edward Bryant. Read for you by Ray Porter. Wednesday. The dead man slammed his fist through the pine door. No knuckles broke, but his skin tore. Blood streaked the wooden shards of door panel. It hurt, but not enough. No, it didn't hurt much at all, other things considered. Other things. What a euphemistic code for people and relationships, lovers and kin. The dirty little politics of rejections and betrayals. Jesus God. They hurt. Real mature, my friend, Jack Robichaud thought. Going through the grieving process at Mach 10, right past denial and directly to self-pity. Real grown-up for a guy into his 40s. Fuck it. He gingerly withdrew his hand from the shattered door. Naturally, the long wooden splinters faced the wrong way. It was like trying to extract his flesh from some sort of toothy trap. Jack turned and walked back into the shambles of his living room. It still looked like Captain Nemo's stateroom on the Nautilus, after the giant squid had wrestled with the submarine in the middle of the Atlantic storm of a century. He loved this room. Love. Funny word to use anymore. Kicking aside a shattered antique sextant, Jack crossed to the outside door, the one opening on a passage leading to the subway maintenance tunnels, and bolted it. As he did so, he caught a last whiff of Michael's sharp citrus aftershave. The image of Michael's retreating back, shoulders slightly hunched with denial, flickered in the space the door occupied, vanished, slipped out of existence with not even a whimper. Jack stepped over the old-fashioned phone crafted as the effigy of Huey Long. Somehow it had miraculously ended on the floor, upright with the earpiece still cradled in Huey's upraised right hand. Old Huey had communicated like a son of a bitch. Why couldn't Jack? He couldn't call Vagabond. He wouldn't call Cordelia. There was no one else he wanted to talk to. Besides, he thought he'd talked enough. He'd spoken to Tachyon. An apple a day hadn't worked. And he had talked to Michael. Who was left? A priest? Not a chance. Atelier Parish was too far behind. Too many years. Too much memory. Jack stepped behind the carved mahogany bar with the brass fittings, smelled the dusty plush velvet hanging as he opened the cabinet. The brandy had cost close to $60. Expensive on a transit worker's salary, but what the hell? He'd always read in sea novels about brandies being administered to survivors of rack and storm, and besides, the cut crystal decanter fit this Victorian room beautifully. He poured himself a triple, drank it like a double, and filled the glass again. He didn't usually gulp like this, but...
There is an interesting fact about Mr. Kaposi, Tachyon had said. His medical smock shone an immaculate white with almost the albedo of an Arctic snowfield.
His red hair seemed aflame under the examining room lights.
Shortly before he discovered and named his sarcoma in 1872, Kaposi had changed his name from Kohn.
Jack stared at him, unable to form the words he wanted to say. What the fuck was Tachyon talking about?
There was, of course, a pogrom in Czechoslovakia, Tachyon said, slender fingers gesturing expressively. He reacted to the sort of ill-informed prejudice that has cursed both jokers, not to mention aces, of course, and AIDS patients alike. Exotic viruses might as well be the evil eye.
Jack looked down at his bare chest, gingerly touching the blue-black bruise-like markings above his ribs.
I don't need no double-barreled curse. One to a customer, no? I'm sorry, Jack.
Tachyon hesitated.
It's difficult to say when you were infected. The tumors are well advanced, but the biopsy and the anomalous workup results suggest there is a synergy going on between the wild card virus and the HIV organism attacking your immunosuppressant system. I suspect some sort of galloping accelerated process. Jack shook his head, as though only half-hearing. I had a negative test a year ago. It's as I feared, then, said the doctor. I can't forecast the progress. I can, said Jack. Tachyon shrugged sympathetically. I must ask, he said, if you habitually use amyl nitrate. Poppers, said Jack. He shook his head. No way, I'm not much on drugs. Tachyon marked something on Jack's chart. Their use is frequently connected with Kaposi's. Jack shook his head again. Then there is another matter, said the doctor. Jack stared at him. It was like trying to look out from the center of a block of ice. He felt numb all over. He knew the psychic shock would go away soon, and then... What? I must ask you this. I need to know about contacts. Jack took a deep breath. There was one. Is one. Only one. I should talk to him. Are you kidding? Said Jack. I will talk to Michael, and then I'll have him come see you, but I'll talk to him first. His voice dropped off. Yeah. I'll talk to him. He proceeded to remind Tachyon of the confidentiality of the doctor-patient relationship. Tachyon seemed affronted. Jack didn't apologize. Then he left. That was in the morning. This was a special occasion. He felt as if he were drinking after his own funeral. Cajuns do great wakes, he said aloud, pouring another brandy. Had the decanter been full? He couldn't remember. Now it was down close to half. He glanced at the phone again. Why the hell did he want to talk to anyone? After all, no one wanted to talk to him. Now that he thought about it, for the last few months, living with Michael had pretty much been like living alone. Now he might as well die alone. Can the self-pity. But it was so easy. So, what's up? Michael had said, closing the door after him before giving Jack a squeeze. No other greeting, no preamble. As light as Jack was dark, tall and slender-limbed, Michael had always seemed to bring something of the sunlit street-level spring down with him to Jack's subterranean dwelling. Not today. Jack couldn't read him at all. Huh? Michael said. Jack turned his face away and disengaged himself from the other's arms. He stepped back. Something wrong? Jack scrutinized Michael's face. His lover's features were the very model of glowing health, of innocence.
You might want to sit down, said Jack.
No, Michael stared at him. Just say whatever it is you want to say. Jack's mouth was dry.
I went to the clinic today.
So?
The tests...
He had to start over.
The tests were positive.
Michael looked at him blankly. Tests?
AIDS.
He said the hateful word. His stomach twisted. No, said Michael. He shook his head. No, not a chance.
Yes,
said Jack. But who? Michael's eyes widened. Jack, did you?
No, Jack stared back. There's been no one. No one else, mon cher.
Michael cocked his head. There has to be. I mean, I wouldn't.
It isn't like Immaculate Conception, Michael. No miracle here. It has to be.
No, said Michael. He shook his head vehemently. It's impossible. His eyes flickered, and he looked away. Then he turned on his heel, opened the door, and left. No, Jack had heard Michael say one more time.
to feel the rusty blade twisting in his gut. The brandy, it occurred to him, was like an emotional tetanus shot. Except it wasn't working. All it did was make him feel worse because it lessened his ability to control what he was feeling. He felt suddenly as if he had inhaled all the oxygen there was to breathe in his home. He wanted to get out, to go up to the streets. So he carefully, with what he realized were exaggerated motions, put away the brandy decanter. Then Jack left by the same door Michael had exited. He followed the ghost's footsteps to the tunnels and ladders that took him up to the streets. He walked. Jack could have taken the track maintenance car down below, but decided he didn't want to. The night was too chilly, but that was fine. He wanted something astringent to cleanse him, to flense the bruise marks, to clean out his flesh. He realized he was wishing there was now some overt pain. He walked uptown, not truly comprehending where he was, until he saw the sign for Young Man's Fancy. "I shouldn't be here, of all places," he thought. He'd met Michael here. He shouldn't be in the West Village at all, and not at this bar. But by now it was too late. Here he was. Shit. He turned to leave.
"Hey, pretty boy. Looking to get some tail? Are you the tail?"
The voice was all too familiar. Jack looked up and saw the memorably over-muscled face, not to mention the body, of Bludgeon emerge from the shadowed downstairs entrance to the closed laundry below the bar. Jack turned and started away. There was the smack of size 18 brogans on the sidewalk, fingers like German sausages curled around his shoulder and spun Jack around.
"The thing about them gorgeous eyes," said Bludgeon, "is that all I gotta do is dig my thumbs in there and they'll pop out like the green cherries on a Wop cookies."
Jack shrugged the fingers away. He felt impatient and not terribly cautious. He just didn't give a damn. "Fuck off," he said.
"You need one of these, too."
Bludgeon put spurned fingers to his own cheek and touched the ragged, inflamed scar that ran all the way from the edge of his right eye to his bulbous chin. Jack remembered the triumphant shriek of Bagabond's black cat. The feline was old, but agile enough to have dodged Bludgeon's flailing fists after the claws had raked down the man's ugly features.
"Cat scratches get infected," Jack said, continuing to back toward the street. "You ought to see to those. I know a real good doctor."
"Chicken shit like you's gonna need an undertaker,"
Bludgeon threatened.
"Mr. Maz'll be real pleased if I bring in your cock in a sandwich bag. Them Gambionis love to make sausage, especially out of yellow dicks like you."
"I don't have time for this," said Jack.
"Gonna make time."
Bludgeon's jaws split in the kind of smirk that can deform unborn babies.
"You and me. I figure I can handle a little gator wrestling."
The door of Young Man's Fancy swung open and a gaggle of about a dozen guys spilled out onto the street. Bludgeon stopped, uncertainly, in mid-stride.
"Witnesses," said Jack. "Down, boy."
"I'll take 'em all," said Bludgeon,
surveying his prospective victims. He smacked the mace-like mutation of his right hand into the palm of his left. It sounded like dropping a beef roast off a stepladder onto a tiled floor. "A little gay bashing?" said the man, apparently leading the others. He grimaced at Bludgeon. "You still hanging around, dork breath?" His hand dipped inside his jacket and came out filled with blued steel. "Want to see my Bernie Getz impression?" He laughed. "It's a guaranteed killer." Bludgeon looked around the semicircle of faces.
"I got a job to protect,"
he finally said to Jack.
"You,"
he said to the man with the gun.
"I'm going to take out your guts with my thumb. Just wait. And you,"
he said back to Jack,
"you, I'm going to really hurt."
"But another time," said Jack.
"Fucking A."
Bludgeon couldn't seem to find a better exit line. He lurched away from the growing crowd of onlookers and stomped down the street. "Pretty rough trade,"
the man with the gun said to Jack. He put the pistol back under his coat. I hope you know what you're doing.
Thanks, said Jack. I don't know the guy. He just stopped me for a light.
He turned and headed the opposite direction, ignoring the murmurs. So, you're welcome, man, said the man with the pistol. Good luck, buddy. Jack turned the corner and headed down a darker block.
Christ, it was cold.
He hugged himself. He hadn't worn a coat. The chill was making him sluggish. Bad sign. He tentatively touched the back of his left hand with the fingers of his right. The skin felt rough, scaly, beginning to transform.
No.
He started to run. He didn't need this too. Not tonight.
Stress symptoms.
He almost giggled. He looked for a subway entrance. It didn't matter which. Red Globe or Green, BMT, IRT, or PATH. Uptown or downtown, just as long as the stairs led down. He searched for the telltale steam from a manhole cover. The sewers would do. That would be better. There'd be no people in the sewers. Those tunnels, warm and slimy, would lead toward the bay. Good hunting. Fine with Jack. He thought about his gator teeth ripping into albino gar. That was okay. Vagabond didn't give much of a shit about mutant fish. Food. Blood, death, exhaustion, blankness. Jack stumbled toward the deeper darkness, homing in on a warm grating.
I'm losing it, he thought.
He saw Michael's face, Vagabond's, Cordelia's. Yeah, he'd lost it all right. Everything. Jack plunged into the night. Thursday. The volume of the bootleg mix of the new George Harrison album was sufficient to shiver the framed pictures on the office wall. But then the size of the office wasn't enough to provide much challenge to the cassette deck's amplifier. It wasn't a large office and didn't occupy the corner of the office tower, but it was a separate office regardless, with permanent walls, and it did have a window. Cordelia Chasson was happy with it. Her desk was old and wooden and held, besides the computer, stacks of albums, tapes, and press kits. The pictures on the opposite wall were photos of Peregrine, David Bowie, Fantasy, Tim Curry, Lou Reed, and other entertainers, whether aces or not. In the midst of the photographs was a framed cross-stitch sampler reading, "Damn, I'm Good." Tacked to the wall behind and to Cordelia's right was a large rectangle of poster board. It held a list of names, copiously emended with crossouts, question marks, and shorthand notes such as Czech Film Startup, Rel Fanatic, and Won't Perform Brit Hall. Her phone beeped to her. It was a few moments before Cordelia noticed. She thumbed down the volume control on the desk and picked up the receiver. Luz Alcala, one of her bosses, said,
My sweet lord Cordelia, do you think you could perhaps use the headphones?
Sorry, said Cordelia.
I got carried away. It's a great album. I've already turned down the volume.
Thank you, said Alcala.
Any word yet on who'll cut the promos for us?
I'm going down the list. Jagger, maybe?
The young woman hesitated.
He hasn't said no.
Have you called him in the last week?
Well, no.
Alcala's voice took on a mildly reproving tone.
Cordelia, I admire what you're accomplishing with the benefit, but GF&G has other projects to consider as well.
I know, said Cordelia. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to juggle a lot of things.
She tried to sound more upbeat and change the subject.
The clearances came through for China this morning. This means we'll be beaming to better than half the world. Not to mention Australia.
Alcala chuckled.
Including Australia.
Call Jagger's agent, said Alcala. Okay?
Okay.
Cordelia hung up the phone. She picked up the small, intricately carved stone lizard shape from the desktop where it had nearly been covered over with a heap of glossies. It was actually an Australian crocodile, but she had been assured that it was her cousin and therefore appropriate as a fetish. She preferred to think of it as a gator. Cordelia replaced the figure,
setting it in front of the small, framed black-and-white photo of a young, Aboriginal man. He scowled seriously out of the portrait.
"Wayungare,"
she whispered. Her lips formed a kiss. Then she swiveled her chair around to face the poster board on the wall. Taking a thick marker, she began crossing out names. What she ended up with was a list of U2, The Boss, Little Steven, The Coward Brothers, and Girls with Guns. Not bad, she thought. Not damn bad at all. But, she chuckled with satisfaction, there was more. She reached up again with the marker. The three of them had eaten an early lunch at the Acropolis on 10th Street, just off 6th Avenue. Cordelia had offered to take them to a plusher place. After all, she had an expense account now. The Acropolis was a mere café, indistinguishable from thousands of others in the city.
"The Riviera's only a few blocks away," she'd said. "It's an okay place."
C.C. Ryder was having none of it. She wanted an anonymous meeting place. She asked that they meet well before the mealtime rush. She wanted Vagabond along. She got what she wanted because Cordelia needed her. So they ended up in the Naugahyde booth with C.C. and Vagabond on the side facing both Cordelia and the door. Cordelia looked up from the menu and smiled.
"I can recommend a fruit cup."
C.C. didn't smile back. Her expression was serious. She took off her nearly shapeless leather pork pie cap and shook out her spiky red hair. Cordelia noticed that Cece's brilliant green eyes looked very much like Uncle Jack's.
"I've got to call him,"
she thought. She didn't want to, but she had to.
"See the raccoon rings?"
said C.C., pointing to her own eyes. Today, she didn't look much like one of Rock's top lyricists and performers. The effect was deliberate. She wore jeans so old and worn they looked acid-washed. Her floppy John Hyatt sweatshirt appeared to have endured almost as many washings.
"Nope,"
said Cordelia. Cece's skin looked smooth and white, almost albino in its lightness.
"Well, there ought to be."
A bare smile ghosted across Cece's lips.
"I've been losing sleep over this whole thing with the benefit."
Cordelia said nothing, kept looking the singer in the eye.
"I know this is Dez's last hurrah," C.C. continued. "And I know the cause is a good one. A joint benefit for AIDS patients and the wildcard victims is something whose time is long since due."
Cordelia nodded. This was looking good. C.C. shrugged.
"I guess I gotta come out of the anxiety closet sometime and perform in front of live folks."
She smiled for real.
"So the answer is yes." "Super!"
Cordelia leaned across the table and hugged C.C. fiercely. Startled, Vagabond half rose from her seat, ready, it seemed to Cordelia, who saw the motion from the corner of her eye, to tear out her throat if she were actually attacking C.C. Cordelia did hear a low snarl, much like one of Vagabond's cats, as she disentangled herself from C.C. and settled back in her seat.
"That's wonderful,"
said Cordelia. She stopped burbling when she saw C.C.'s face. She could read the expression.
"I'm sorry,"
Cordelia sobered.
"It's just that I've loved your music, loved you as a writer for so long. I've wanted to see you perform your songs more than just about anything."
"It's not going to be easy," said C.C.
Vagabond looked at her concernedly.
"What have we got, 10 days?
Cordelia nodded.
"Barely."
"I'm going to need every minute."
"You've got it. I'm going to give you someone as a liaison with me who will get you whatever you want, whenever you need it. Somebody I trust, and so do you." "Who's that?"
said Vagabond with evident suspicion. The muscles of her gaunt face tightened, her brown eyes narrowed. Cordelia took a deep breath.
"Uncle Jack,"
she said. The expression on Vagabond's face was not pleasant.
"Why?"
she said. C.C. glanced aside at her.
"Why not me?" "You can help C.C. as much as you want,"
said Cordelia hastily.
"But I need Uncle Jack to be involved with all this. He's competent, he's level-headed, and he's trustworthy. I'm in over my head,"
she said candidly.
"I need all the help I can scrounge." "Jack know about this?"
said Vagabond. Cordelia hesitated.
"Well, I've been waiting to tell him.
She realized the Cajun was starting to creep through more as she got flustered. She took a mental grip on herself.
I've been leaving messages on his phone machine. He hasn't been answering.
Vagabond leaned back in her seat and closed her eyes. A minute went by. It seemed a long time. The Greek waiter came by to take their orders. Cece told him to come back shortly. When she opened her eyes again, Vagabond shook her head as though clearing it.
I don't know when the boy's going to answer your calls. What do you mean?
Cordelia felt a listing feeling as though her plans were papers sliding off a carefully leveled table.
It's all broken up,
said Vagabond.
Jack's a ways off. Probably about New York Bay, I'd judge. He's getting his rocks off duking it out with the kind of critters you don't see in the Castle Clinton Aquarium. As much raw meat as he's getting.
She smiled humorlessly.
I couldn't say whether he's going to get home for dinner anytime soon.
Quelle damnation,
Cordelia muttered.
In any case,
she said to Cece,
call me at the office tomorrow morning and I'll have something lined out, either Uncle Jack or someone else. Make it someone else,
said Vagabond. Cordelia smiled placatingly. The waiter returned and she ordered the fruit cup. And marked Cece down on the roster of benefit performers in bold black letters.
Doggone it,
Cordelia said aloud to herself.
I'm good.
Then she hesitated and glanced back at the copy of the Village Voice lying on the desk. A small events notice in microscopic type was circled in red. She scrolled one additional name on the board. Friday.
Merde.
No two ways about it. That's what he felt like as he dragged into his home in the early morning. There was nothing welcome about entering the shambles of his living room. Jack stumbled through the debris. Ahead of him, he saw the shattered door to his bedroom. His hand still hurt, but now so did his teeth. His head, his hands. It seemed to him that every bone in his body ached.
Enfer,
he swore as he saw the blinking red light of his answering machine. He almost managed to ignore the single-eyed demon. Then he bent and slapped the playback switch. Three of the messages were from his supervisor. Jack knew he'd better call back later in the morning or he'd have no job to return to. He liked living down here, and he enjoyed the privilege of gainful employment down in the darkness. The other eight messages were from Cordelia. They were not very informative, but neither did they sound like emergencies. Cordelia kept saying it was important for Jack to get back to her, but the tone didn't indicate mortal peril. Jack rewound the message tape and turned off the machine, then went into the kitchen. He surveyed the refrigerator and didn't bother opening it. He knew what was inside. More, he simply wasn't hungry. He had some idea of what he had devoured over the past day and night and didn't want to think about it. Blind albino gar. You wouldn't find that on the menu at any Cajun restaurant in New York. He went into the bedroom and flopped down on the bed. There was no question of undressing. Jack only moved sufficiently to wind the antique quilt around himself. He was out. The phone by the bed awoke him at 8 a.m. precisely. He knew this because the red LED numerals on the clock burned themselves into his retinas when he finally opened his eyes and reached over to stop the shrilling that was scraping his inner ear into shreds.
Yeah.
Uncle Jack?
Yeah, Cordy.
He came a good deal more awake.
It's me, Uncle Jack. I'm sorry if I woke you. I've been trying to get you for better than a day.
He yawned and adjusted the receiver so the pillow would hold it snug.
It's okay, Cordy. I got to call the boss and tell him I'm down with something and been too sick to phone the last couple days.
Cordelia sounded alarmed.
You really sick?
Jack yawned again, remembered what he could have said.
Pink of health. Just went off on a bender, that's all.
Vagabond said.
Vagabond?
Yes.
Cordelia seemed to be picking her words carefully.
I asked her to look for you. She said you were out in the bay, killing things?
That about describes it,
said Jack.
Something wrong?
He waited a few seconds before answering, took a breath.
Stress, Cordy. That's all. I needed to unwind.
She didn't sound wholly convinced, but finally said,
Whatever you say, Uncle Jack. Say, listen, do you mind if I come by tonight after work and bring along a friend?
Who? Jack said guardedly.
Cece.
Jack thought about her, remembered visiting her in Tachyon's clinic. He owned everything she'd ever recorded, albums and tapes both, shelved out in the next room.
I guess so, he said. It'll give me an excuse to clean up the house.
No need,
said Cordelia. He laughed.
Oh, yeah, there is a need.
5:30 okay?
Should be. By the way, he said, what's this all about?
She was candid.
I need your help, Uncle Jack.
She filled him in on how things were proceeding with logistics for the benefit.
I'm snowed,
she said.
I cannot do everything.
I don't know much about putting on this kind of event.
You know rock and roll,
she said.
Better you can handle just about anything that happens.
Almost anything, he thought.
Tachyon's face floated in front of him, Michael's.
Flatterer, he said.
Vérité?
A few moments went by.
One thing I got to ask, said Jack. We haven't been talking much.
I know,
she said.
I know. For now, I'm just not thinking much about it.
No resolution, then?
Not yet.
Thanks for being honest.
More seconds went by. It seemed as though Cordelia wanted to say something, but finally all she said was,
Okay. Thanks then, Uncle Jack. I'll be by with Cece at 5:30. Bye.
Jack listened to the silence until the circuit disconnected. Then he turned over and dialed his supervisor at the transit department. He wouldn't have to concentrate to sound convincingly sick. When he opened the door to Cordelia and Cece late in the afternoon, Jack realized that cleaning up his living room probably had been the easier part of the day. Cordelia's eyes seemed to squint as she looked at him, as though she were actually seeing two images and trying to choose the one she would perceive.
Uncle Jack,
she said. There was a stiff instant as she appeared to debate whether to give him a hug. The woman standing beside her diffused the moment.
Jack,
said Cece.
It's good to see you again.
She stepped past Cordelia into the living room, giving Jack a firm hug and a warm kiss on the lips.
You know something?
She said.
Even though I didn't know what was going on for a long time, it really meant a lot, your coming to visit me in the clinic. Anything ever happens to you, you know I'll be there every visiting period, okay?
She grinned.
Okay, he said.
Mon Dieu,
said Cordelia, looking around Jack's home.
What happened here?
Jack's restoration efforts had not been totally successful. Some of the smashed antique furniture was stacked to one side of the room. He hadn't the heart to take it topside to a dumpster. There was still the chance of careful repair and restoration.
When I was coming in last night, he said, I slipped.
Shot while trying to escape,
said Cordelia ironically.
Whatever happened, Uncle Jack, I'm really sorry. This was such a beautiful place.
It still ain't shabby, said Cece, plopping down in a claw-footed love seat. She spread her arms as she sank into the overstuffed upholstery.
This is great,
she smiled up at Jack.
Got some coffee?
Sure, he said. It's all made.
Vagabond was going to come along,
Cece started to say.
She had some errands uptown,
said Cordelia.
I think she'd want me to say hello, said Cece.
Sure. Right, he thought.
Cordelia offered to help with the coffee, but he shooed her back to the living room. When everyone was settled with a steaming mug and a plate of scones with strawberry preserves, Jack said,
So?
So,
said Cece.
Your niece is very persuasive, but so's my own ego. I'm going to come out of seclusion for the benefit, Jack. Back to public performance. Cold turkey. Nothing half-assed. A couple billion potential viewers. There I'll be in front of God and everybody.
She chuckled.
Nothing like hitting acute agoraphobia head on.
Pretty gutsy, said Jack. I'm glad you're doing it. New stuff?
Some old, some new, she said. Some borrowed, some blues. It all depends on what the boss here, Cece gestured at Cordelia, gives me for time. 20 minutes, said Cordelia. That's what everybody gets. The boss, girls with guns, you. Equality's a great thing.
Cece looked back at Jack.
So you're going to help me get ready for the big night?
Said Jack.
GF&G can persuade the transit people to give you time off, said Cordelia quickly. I talked to one of the guys in community relations. They think it'd be terrific to have one of their own involved in something like this.
Uh-huh, said Jack.
With pay, Cordelia said. And GF&G will give you a fee, too.
I've got savings, Jack said quietly.
Uncle Jack, I need you.
I've heard that before. Gently, this time.
So I say it to you again.
It seemed to him Cordelia's voice, her expression, her eyes, were all one coordinated appeal.
It would be good to work with you,
said Cece. She winked one emerald eye.
Free backstage pass. Rub shoulders with the stars.
Jack looked from one woman to the other.
Okay, he finally said. It's a deal.
Great,
said Cordelia.
I'll start feeding you the details, but there's one more thing I want to mention now.
Why do I have the feeling, said Jack, that I ought to be a gator at this very moment looking up at the gaff?
You have plans for tomorrow night?
Cordelia said. Jack spread his hands.
I thought I'd maybe refinish some chairs.
You're coming with us to New Brunswick.
New Jersey?
Cordelia nodded.
We're going to the Holodome. We're going to see Buddy Holly.
Jack said,
The Buddy Holly? I thought he was dead.
He's been on the lounge circuit for years. I saw a note about his appearance in The Voice. She wants him for the benefit, said Cece again.
A nostalgia act,
said Jack. Cordelia was actually blushing.
I grew up with his music. I worship the man. I mean, nothing set with the benefit in him. I just want us to go see him and find out if he's anything like he used to be.
You may be in for a rude shock, said Cece. Guitar of clay and all that.
I'll risk it.
Not Fade Away is one of my favorite songs ever, said Jack. Count me in.
Tell him,
Cece said to Cordelia.
Vagabond's going too,
she said reluctantly.
I don't know about this, said Jack.
He thought about his first encounter with Bludgeon, when the black cat had saved him from having to tangle with the psychopathic gay basher. Had the cat been acting on his own or at Vagabond's suggestion? He'd never asked the woman. Maybe he would tomorrow night.
Uncle Jack,
said Cordelia. He smiled at her.
Less rock.
Saturday.
Oh, my God,
Cece said, sufficiently low that only Jack heard.
He's covering Prince. Goddamned Prince.
And not very well, said Jack.
Cordelia had worried, because of glacial traffic in the Holland Tunnel, that the four of them would be late for Buddy Holly's first set. She also fretted that Jersey Youth would make off with the Mercedes she'd borrowed from Luz Alcala.
It's a Holiday Inn, said Jack as they pulled into the entrance.
So?
The parking lot's illuminated, said Jack.
There's an empty space close to the lobby,
said Cordelia with relief.
You want me to slip 10 to the clerk to keep an eye on the car?
Would you?
Said Cordelia seriously. So they'd parked and secured the Mercedes and entered the New Brunswick Holodome. The trip over from the city had been tense enough. Jack had ridden shotgun in front with Cordelia driving. Vagabond sat in back on the opposite side, as far from Jack as she could get. Both Cece and Cordelia had done their best to keep a conversation going. Jack decided it was an inappropriate time to quiz Vagabond about whether his erstwhile rescuer, the Black Cat, had been acting autonomously or on his mistress's orders.
This is gonna be great, said Cordelia.
She had slotted a cassette of Buddy Holly and the Crickets' Greatest Hits into the Blaupunkt player. The speaker system was far, far better than adequate.
Cordelia,
said Vagabond.
I like Buddy a lot, but maybe so he doesn't hurt my ears. Oh, sorry,
said Cordelia. She turned the volume knob down to barely endurable. Then Saturday evening traffic slowed to a stop-and-go creep within the tunnel. The stench of auto exhaust rose up in visible clouds, and the four in the Mercedes listened to all of Cordelia's Buddy Holly tapes before they reached New Jersey. Cordelia had become more nervous the later it got.
Maybe there'll be a warm-up group,
she'd muttered. There hadn't been, but it turned out not to matter. When the four walked through the door of the Holodome Lounge, they saw there was no need to worry about seats. Perhaps half the booths and tables were vacant. Clearly, Saturday night bacchanalia in New Brunswick didn't center here. They took a table about 10 feet from the low stage, Jack and Vagabond on opposite sides, buffered by CC and Cordelia. And Buddy Holly covered Prince. Jack recognized Holly from the album Portraits. He knew the musician was 49, close enough to Jack's own age. Holly looked older. His face carried too much flesh. His belly wasn't completely camouflaged by the silver lamé jacket. He no longer wore the familiar old black horn rims. His eyes were masked by stylish aviator shades that couldn't quite hide the dark bags. But he still played the Fender Telecaster like an angel. The same couldn't be said for his sidemen. The rhythm guitarist and the bass player both looked about 17. Their playing was not inspired. The muddy sound mix didn't help. The drummer flailed at his snares, the volume coming through at about the right level to completely mask Holly's vocal delivery. In rapid order, Buddy Holly segued from Prince into a bad Billy Idol and then a so-so Bon Jovi.
I don't believe it,
said CC, drinking a healthy dollop of her Campari and tonic.
All he's doing is covering top 40 shit.
Cordelia watched silently, her expression of initial enthusiasm visibly fading. Vagabond shook her head disapprovingly.
We shouldn't have come.
Maybe, Jack thought, he's biding his time. Give him a little while.
As the desultory clapping faded after a game attempt at evoking Ted Nugent, a voice from the back of the lounge yelled, "Come on, buddy, give us some oldies!" A ragged cheer went up. Most of the clapping came from Cordelia's table. Buddy Holly took his Telecaster by the neck and leaned toward the audience.
"Well," he said, the West Texas twang still pronounced, "I don't usually take requests, but since you've been such a terrific crowd."
He settled back and strummed out a rapid-fire sequence of opening chords that his backup group more or less followed.
"Oh, Lord," said CC.
She took another drink as Buddy Holly tore into Tommy Rowe's Hooray for Hazel, then a quick verse of Sheila, finally a lugubrious, almost bluesy version of Bobby Vinton's Red Roses for a Blue Lady. Holly continued in that vein. He played a lot of music made famous by Bobbies and Tommies in the 50s and 60s.
"I want to hear Cindy Lou, or That'll Be the Day, or It's So Easy, or Tea Town,"
said Cordelia, distractedly swirling her gin and tonic.
"Not this shit."
"I settle for Not Fade Away," Jack thought.
He watched Buddy Holly slog through the dismal pop retrospective and started getting real depressed. It was enough to make him maybe wish that Holly had died at the height of his initial popularity and not survived to fall into this ghastly self-mockery. Inebriated conversation and drunken laughter escalated at the surrounding tables. It appeared that most in the lounge had completely forgotten that Buddy Holly was performing on stage. When Holly came to the end of his set, he introduced the final number very simply.
"This is something new," he said.
The sparse crowd was having none of it. They had turned actively hostile.
"Fuck you," somebody shouted. "Turn on the jukebox."
Holly shrugged, turned, walked off the stage. His backup guitarists quietly put their instruments down. The drummer got up and laid his sticks on an amp.
"Why doesn't he do his classics?"
said Cordelia.
"Hang on,"
she said to her companions. Then she got up and collared Buddy Holly as he headed toward the bar. They saw her talking earnestly to the man. She led him back to the table, dragged up a vacant chair, appeared to be making him sit through dint of sheer will. Holly looked bemused at the whole affair. Cordelia made introductions. The musician courteously acknowledged each name and shook hands in turn. Jack found the man's grip warm and firm, not flabby at all. Cordelia said,
"We're four of your greatest fans."
"Sort of sorry you're all here," said Holly. "I feel like I owe everyone an apology. This isn't a good show tonight."
He shrugged.
"Of course, most nights in lounges are like that."
Holly smiled self-deprecatingly.
"Why don't you play your own music?"
said Vagabond without preamble.
"Your old music,"
said Cordelia.
"The great stuff."
Holly looked around the table.
"I've got my reasons,"
he said.
"It ain't a matter of not wanting to. I just can't."
"Well,"
said Cordelia, smiling,
"maybe I can help change your mind."
She launched into her spiel about the benefit at the funhouse, about how Holly could go on early in the following Saturday's performance, that maybe he could do a medley of the music that had propelled him to superstardom in the 50s and early 60s, that perhaps, just maybe, the concert and the telecast could rejuvenate his career.
"Just like when the boss found Gary U.S. Bonds playing in bars like this,"
she finished up. Buddy Holly looked honestly astonished by Cordelia's outpouring of enthusiasm. He put his elbows on the table, closely studying the club soda and lime the waitress had brought him, finally looking up at her with a slight smile.
"Listen," he said, "I thank you.
I truly do.
Hearing something like this makes my night. Hell, the whole year."
He looked away.
"But I can't do it."
"But you can,"
said Cordelia. He shook his head.
"Think about it."
"Won't do no good," he said. "It won't work."
He patted her hand.
"But thanks for the thought."
And with that, he nodded to the rest of them, then got up and trudged through the smoke to the stage for his second set.
"Damn,"
said Cordelia. Jack watched the musician's back as Holly hoisted himself up onto the stage. There was something familiar about how the man carried himself. It was the sense of defeat. Jack thought he'd last seen that slight slumping of shoulders and hanging of head when he'd looked in the mirror just this morning. He wondered how many years and what disasters had beaten Buddy Holly down. "I wish." At first, the thought didn't complete itself. Then he said to himself, "I wish I could help."
"You want to go or stay?"
said CC to Cordelia.
"Go,"
said Cordelia. Almost too low to be heard, she continued,
"But I think I'll be back." "Like MacArthur?"
said Vagabond.
"More like Sergeant Preston of the Mounties,"
said Cordelia. Sunday.
"So who are you calling a chickie?"
said Cordelia, voice colder than the ocean off Jones Beach.
"What I be saying," said the Holiday Inn morning clerk, "is that we can't be giving out guests' room numbers to just any chicken what comes along."
He smiled at her.
"Rules."
"You want to know how early I had to get up to catch a train out here?"
Cordelia demanded.
"Do you know how long I waited for a cab at the New Brunswick station?"
The clerk's easy smile started to fray at the lips.
"Sorry."
"I'm not a goddamned groupie."
Cordelia slapped an expensively embossed business card down on the counter.
"I'm trying to make Holly a star."
"Already was."
The clerk picked up the card and examined it. Below Cordelia's name, it read Associate Producer. The escalated job title had been in lieu of a raise.
"No shit. You work with GF&G, the folks who do the Robert Townsend show and all that Spike Lee stuff?"
He sounded halfway impressed.
"No shit,"
said Cordelia. She tried smiling.
"Honest."
"And you're gonna pull Buddy Holly out of this shithole?"
"Gonna try."
"Okay,"
said the clerk, grinning. He glanced at the registration spinner.
"Room 8420.
He looked at Cordelia significantly.
"So?"
With a tone of voice that suggested, "Don't you know nothing?" the clerk said,
"The main roads leading out of Lubbock, the highway to Nashville."
"Oh,"
said Cordelia. Buddy Holly had been asleep when Cordelia knocked on the door of room 8420 at 9:25. That had been obvious when he opened the door. His gray-streaked black hair was in disarray. His glasses were slightly askew as he peered out into the hallway.
It's me, Cordelia Chasson, remember from last night?
Right. Holly seemed to gather himself.
Can I help you? I'm here to take you to breakfast. I need to talk with you. It's quite important.
Buddy Holly shook his head bemusedly.
Are you the irresistible force or the immovable object?
Cordelia shrugged.
Give me 10, said Holly. I'll meet you down in the lobby.
Promise?
Said Cordelia. Holly smiled slightly, nodded, and shut the door. Buddy Holly came to the breakfast table in crisp denim jeans, a flowered western shirt, and a brown corduroy jacket. He looked somewhat the worse for wear, but comfortable. He seated himself and said,
"You going to evangelize me again?"
"If I can. We can talk about that after we get some coffee."
"Tea for me," he said. "Herbal. I brought my own. The tea selection in the kitchen is pretty shabby."
The waitress came and took their order.
"Around your neck," said Holly, pointing with his glance. "That a fetish? I saw it last night, but I was preoccupied."
Cordelia unhooked the clasp and passed the fetish over. The tiny silver alligator and the fossil tooth were bound to the delicate oval of sandstone with a tough strand of dried gut. Holly turned the object over and over, examining it closely.
"Doesn't look American Southwest. Polynesian? Australia, maybe?"
"Pretty good," said Cordelia. "Aboriginal."
"What tribe? I know the Aranda pretty well, even the Wikmunkan and the Murnjin. This just ain't familiar."
"It was made by a young urban aborigine,"
said Cordelia. She hesitated a moment. It both excited and hurt her to think of Wyangari. And how, she wondered, was the Central Australian Revolution, such as it was, going? She'd been too busy with the benefit to watch much news.
"He gave it to me as a going-away gift."
"Let me guess," said Holly. "The sandstones from Uluru."
Cordelia nodded. "Uluru, true name of what the Europeans called Ayers Rock."
"And the reptile's your totem, of course."
He held the object up to the light before passing it back over.
"There's considerable power here, not just a token."
She refastened the chain.
"How do you know?"
He grinned crookedly at her.
"Just don't laugh too loud, okay?"
Cordelia felt puzzled.
"Okay."
"Ever since things went to hell, since they fell apart around 1972, he said hesitantly, "I've been looking around."
He contemplatively sipped his tea.
"For what?"
Cordelia finally said.
"For whatever. For anything that meant something. I was just searching."
Cordelia thought for a moment.
"Spirituality?"
Holly nodded vehemently.
"Absolutely. The limos were gone, the homes, the private jet, and the high living, the..."
He stopped in mid-sentence.
"All gone. There had to be something else besides hitting the bottle and the bottom."
"And you found it?"
"I'm still hunting."
He met her gaze and smiled.
"A lot of years and a lot of miles. You know something? I'm a lot more popular in Africa and the rest of the world than I am here. Back in 75, my agent gave me a last chance and booked me into this crazy Pan-African tour. Things fell apart. Well, I fell apart. I really got screwed up after I backed out of a gig in Joburg. Somehow, I stole a Land Rover and ended up drinking 2/5 of Jim Beam way out in the bush. You know how alcohol poisoning works? Shoot, I was well on my way."
Cordelia stared at him, held entranced by the flat West Texas twang. The man was a storyteller.
"Bushmen found me. Tribesmen from out of the Kalahari. First thing I knew was a Tsong shaman leaning down over me and letting out the most ungodly screams you ever heard. Later I found out he was taking the sickness into himself and then getting shed of it into the air."
Holly contemplatively touched the pad of his thumb to his incisors. That was the beginning.
And since?
Said Cordelia. I keep looking. I search everywhere. When I played a string of bars in the Dakotas in the Midwest, I learned about Rolling Thunder and the generations of Black Elk. The more I learned, the more I wanted to know. His voice took on a dreamy quality. When I was with the Lakota, I cried for a vision. The shaman took me through the Inyipi ceremony and sent me up the hill to receive the Wakong, the holy beings. Holly smiled ruefully. The thunder beings came, but that was about all. I got wet and cold. He shrugged. So it goes.
You keep searching,
said Cordelia. I do that, said Holly. I learn. I've been off booze since South Africa. No more drugs either. As for what I'm learning, it ain't easy to work with a hard-shell Baptist growing up, but that's what I've tried to do. It occurred to Cordelia that, for all he'd been saying, Buddy Holly still seemed very anchored in the physical universe. She didn't have the same sense of ethereal dissociation that she'd gotten from spiritually transformed rock stars such as Cat Stevens or Richie Furay. She nibbled a bite from her neglected English muffin.
Most of what I know about this, I learned from my Aboriginal friend. But I've thought about it. Sometimes in my job, I wonder whether rock stars, pop singers, entertainers in the public eye in America are sort of the contemporary equivalent of shamans.
Holly nodded, seriously.
Men and women of power, absolutely.
They have the magic.
Buddy Holly laughed.
Fortunately, the ones who believe they do usually have nothing, and the ones who truly possess the power don't consciously know it.
Cordelia finished her muffin.
The performers at the benefit concert next Saturday all have the power.
Holly looked wary.
I'm changing the subject,
Cordelia said lightly.
I don't think things have changed since last night. You want me to play all my old standards. I just can't do that.
Is this...
Cordelia hunted for words.
Is this a crisis of confidence?
That's probably part of it.
Same thing happened with C.C. Ryder,
said Cordelia.
But she changed her mind. She's going to appear.
Good for her.
Holly hesitated.
The truth is, I can't play the songs you want me to do.
Why not?
I don't own them anymore. Long about the time things went to hell, a New York outfit called Shrike Music bought up my entire catalog. They're real sweethearts. Ever see their logo? A quarter note stuck on a spike. They've been keeping my songs on ice. I hate it, but I can't do spit to get them back. Holly spread his hands helplessly.
We'll see,
said Cordelia without hesitation.
GF&G's got some pull. Is that the only other catch?
You think you can do anything, don't you?
Holly smiled as he shook his head. This time it was a genuine smile. His teeth were even and white.
Okay, look. You spring some of my music loose and maybe we've got a deal, just for old time's sake.
I don't understand,
said Cordelia.
Well, let me tell you something,
said Buddy Holly. Animation filled his features and his voice.
Back in high school, in Lubbock, back when Bob Montgomery and I were first putting together a band and doing some crazy recordings, there was a girl. I thought she was just... Well,
he took a deep breath and smiled shyly.
You know the storyline. She never noticed me at all. A couple years later, she was still in my head when I recorded Girl on My Mind in Nashville.
That was about the time Decca wanted me to sound like everyone else with a rock and roll hit in 1956. I sort of got out of the formula with Girl. He shook his head.
So anyway, you remind me of her. She knew her own way, too.
He leaned back in his seat and regarded her.
That's a great story,
said Cordelia.
It's just like...
Rock and roll,
Holly finished. They both laughed. Things, thought Cordelia, were back on track. Monday. First thing Monday morning, Cordelia sat at her desk and contemplated her sins while she waited on hold with the Rights and Permissions Department at Shrike Music. The background tape for Shrike's hold circuit was classical, somber, and dirge-like. Cordelia suspected it was a deliberate psych-out tactic. It occurred to her as she examined her nails that she had not yet tried to contact Mick Jagger. Lusakala would not be happy. At least she had gotten the Mercedes back to Luce without a scratch or dent. Well, there were priorities. It seemed very important to secure Buddy Holly for the Funhouse benefit. She riffled through the phone messages that had been stacked on her desk. U2's manager wanted her to know that the Edge had got his fingers caught in a car door over the weekend. U2 just might be without the services of their guitarist. Maybe, she thought, she could convince Bono to do an acoustic set? The tech people had left a note alerting her that ShowSat 3 was acting up over the Indian Ocean. They were working on it. They were somewhat confident that malfunctioning relays could be cleared.
Somewhat?
She thought. Shit. Somewhat had better translate into absolutely. She knew damn well she didn't have the clout to get GF&G to commission a shuttle repair flight with 5 days' notice. With any notice.
Christ, what was she thinking?
Cordelia gulped some coffee and glared down at the phone. How long was Shrike going to hang her up? Another note was from Tammy, the half-Eskimo lead guitarist of Girls with Guns. The world's greatest all-women neo-punker band was stranded in Billings, and could Cordelia wire just enough cash so that all the members of the band could get to New York by Saturday? Probably. Cordelia jotted a note. Talk to Luce. There was a double beep on the phone, and a voice said,
Miss Delvecchio, Rights and Permissions.
Cordelia introduced herself, sounding as calm, self-assured, and in control as she could manage. She sounded good to her.
I want to talk about Buddy Holly's catalog,
Cordelia said.
I understand Shrike holds the rights. Here at Global Fun and Games, we're very much looking forward to having Mr. Holly perform a selection of his past hits at this weekend's Global Benefit for Medical Victims.
There was a brief silence.
What sort of medical victims?
Cordelia didn't like the sound of her voice. South Bronx, probably.
AIDS and the wildcard virus. The live video feed will reach...
Miss Delvecchio interrupted her.
All right, that benefit. I'm sorry, Miss Chesson, but it will be quite impossible to cooperate with Global on this project. I am sorry.
She didn't sound sorry.
But surely there... Shrike owns Mr. Holly's music under an exclusive license. We just won't be able to release the permissions you need.
The tone of her voice said, and that's final.
Perhaps if I could speak with your department head. I'm afraid Mr. Lazarus isn't in today. Well, maybe. Thank you for thinking of us, Ms. Chesson,
said Miss Delvecchio.
Have a nice day.
And she hung up. Cordelia stared at the phone for a minute or two. Damn it. She hoped Miss Delvecchio would have an extremely difficult period. After another minute, she switched on the desk terminal and pulled up the online variety. She flipped through a few electronic pages at random and then turned on the modem and dialed up Variety's index base. While there were quite a few keyword entries for Shrike Music, but not many for Buddy Holly, there was one story that flagged both. It was dated nearly 3 months before, while she had been in Australia. It seemed that Shrike Music had inked a megabucks deal with America's second largest advertising firm. The advertising company was a client of a major evangelical organization that was looking to market its theme amusement parks and other commercial subsidiaries through what the article, quoting Leo Barnett, termed the innocent but energetic nostalgia of Buddy Holly's music.
Oh,
Cordelia thought.
Oh, no.
No wonder Shrike wasn't eager to have Holly's songs associated with the benefit. This was going to be a problem. Luce Alcala stuck her head through the office door and said,
Good morning, Cordelia. Did you have a good weekend?
Cordelia looked up.
Definitely. You get your keys okay? Thanks again for the car.
Luce nodded.
You all right? You look a bit distracted. It's just Monday morning.
Luce smiled sympathetically.
By the way, did you reach our lycanthropic friend?
Cordelia shook her head, thought fast.
Still can't find him. Let me give you a suggestion. After you try their management, call the presidents of the companies they record for. When you can't get satisfaction, go upstairs. It almost always works.
Aha,
thought Cordelia.
Thanks, she said.
After Luce chatted a little more and then left, Cordelia dialed Shrike back and asked for the president's office. After two layers of secretaries, she finally reached one Anthony Michael Cardwell. Cardwell was more sympathetic than Miss Delvecchio, but ultimately no more helpful. True, Shrike Music has a responsibility to the community, and we participate in many projects toward that end, but ultimately, we are responsible to our shareholders and our corporate owners, he said. I believe you can appreciate the difficulty of our position.
Bullshit,
Cordelia thought, furious. What she said was much the same thing, definitely too blunt. The president of Shrike Music cut the conversation short. After setting the phone down, Cordelia drummed her fingers on the desktop. Go upstairs, Luce had said. Cordelia touched the terminal keyboard and called up GF&G's research list of entertainment industry databases. As she started to dig out the roots of Shrike's corporate family tree, she wondered how Jack was doing. Naturally, Jack had believed Cordelia when she had told him Sunday night that things looked good so far as obtaining permission for Holly to play his own music. More, GF&G would take care of Jack's leave of absence Monday morning. That would free Jack so he could help move Holly into Manhattan. Cordelia had arranged a room downtown at the Hotel California, Manhattan's premier hostelry for visiting musicians.
The management, Cordelia had said, doesn't care what happens to a room so long as the damage gets paid for. Platinum Amex cards are welcome.
By noon Monday, while Cordelia was playing Silicon Nancy Drew, Jack had moved Buddy Holly into his eighth-floor room at the Hotel California. You've got an open account, the desk clerk had said. So they ordered up sumptuous lunches. Jack watched as Holly unpacked a compact tape deck and a box of cassettes. There was an eclectic selection of New Age music, lots of Wyndham Hill albums, along with starkly packaged relaxation tapes of wind, storm, sea, rain, and a varied lot of early rock, blues, and country. Got some scarce stuff here, said Holly, picking up a handful of what were obviously home-dubbed tapes. Tiny Bradshaw, Lonnie Johnson, Bill Doggett, King Curtis, got the better-known stuff, too. Roy Orbison, Buddy Knox, Doug Somm. He chuckled. A real Texas collection, those last boys. Also have some George Jones. Got a soft spot in my heart for that boy, too. Me and my first band played behind him back in 55 on the Hank Conkren show. What's that? Jack pointed at what seemed to be the only vinyl record in the box of tapes. I'm real proud of that. Holly held up the 45. Jolie Blonde, Waylon Jennings' first record. I produced that for him back when he was playing with the Crickets. Jack took the record and examined it gingerly, as though looking at a holy relic. I guess maybe I heard this on WSN. Yep, said Holly. Just about everybody I respect from that era learned about music first from listening to the Grand Ole Opry. Jack set down the 45 of Jolie Blonde. A tremendous lassitude swept across him. He looked at the remains of lunch. Nausea rocked back and forth in his belly. He sat back on the hotel couch and tried to keep his voice steady.
Before I came to New York, I listened to the Opry all the time. Once I was here, I found a station out of Virginia that carried it.
You come from the same place as your niece? Holly said interestedly. Jack nodded. Alligator, your totem too? Jack said nothing, trying to control the new pain in his gut.
Gator's a powerful guardian animal spirit, said Holly. I wouldn't mess with one.
Jack doubled up and tried not to whimper. Holly was at his side.
Something wrong?
He ran his hands down Jack's chest and stomach. His fingers fluttered lightly over the man's belly. He whistled.
Oh, man, I think you got some trouble here. I know, said Jack. He groaned.
Any other year, he'd be pretty sure he could avoid the flu-type stomach bugs, but Tachyon had briefed him about opportunistic infections. He'd had the instant image of viruses zeroing in on him from every pest hole in the world.
I think maybe it's just a flu.
Holly shook his head. It's a heavy-duty power intrusion I'm picking up here.
It's a bug.
And the bug's getting through to you because your protection, your personal mantle, is screwed.
Couldn't have put it better myself, said Jack.
Holly took his hands away from Jack's abdomen. Sorry, nothing personal. I don't know if Cordelia told you, but I... Well, I know something about this stuff. Jack looked back at him bewilderedly. What you need, said Holly seriously, is a traditional treatment. You need to have the intrusion sucked out. I think it's the only way. Jack couldn't help himself. He started chuckling, then guffawing. He couldn't remember the last time he'd laughed like this. It hurt to laugh, but it helped as well. Buddy Holly looked on, apparently astonished. Finally, Jack straightened a bit and said,
Sorry, I just don't think, sucking an intrusion out of my body would be a real wise idea right now.
Don't get me wrong, said Holly. I'm talking about a psychic thing, pulling out the cause of the discomfort, using the power of the soul and the mind.
I'm not, Jack started laughing again. But, dude, he did feel better.
By 2 in the afternoon, Cordelia had accessed both the New York Public Library reference base and the Public Records DB in Albany. She covered several notebook pages with scrawled numbers and notes. Her task was akin to one of the thousand-piece jigsaw puzzles she never had the patience to finish. Shrike Music was a wholly owned subsidiary of Monopoly Holdings, a New York corporation. Cordelia had dialed Monopoly's Central Manhattan number and tried for the president. Whom she eventually got was the executive vice president for corporate affairs. The man told her the Buddy Holly matter was not his to comment upon, but that she should send a detailed letter to Monopoly's president, one Connell McRae. But couldn't Cordelia speak to McRae directly? She inquired. The president was indisposed. It was hard to say when he'd be back in the office. Cordelia ascertained from public records that Monopoly Holdings was a division of the Infundibulum Corporation, a consortium controlled by Carabank in Nassau. The call to Infundibulum netted her a frustrating 20 minutes holding for an equally unsatisfactory conversation with the CEO's executive assistant. The long-distance call to Nassau got her a heavily accented Bahamian voice claiming complete confusion about this Holly chap. After hanging up, Cordelia regarded the frustration the phone represented.
I think I go home now, she said to herself.
A break was in order. She could come back to the office later and work all night. Veronica and Cordelia shared a high-rise apartment downtown on Maiden Lane. There wasn't much of a view. The living room windows looked out on a narrow courtyard with 11th-floor neighbors only 30 feet away. At first, it had been like watching very dull big-screen TV. Cordelia quickly learned to ignore the rest of the building. It was pleasant just having her own small room. Veronica could use the rest of the apartment as she pleased. Cordelia had made the maximum use of her room, engaging a Soho carpenter to build an inexpensive frame of 2x4s to support her bed. Instant sleeping loft. She just had to remember not to roll off the top during the night. The 6 feet of space beneath the mattress allowed her a closet, bookshelves, and space to store her albums. That left her most of the wall space for prints and posters. One wall was dominated by a color poster of Ayers Rock at Dawn. The opposite wall had the common When You're Up to Your Ass in Alligators poster, but with the Tired Maxim's payoff amended in black marker to read, You Know You're Home. Cordelia was slotting a Suzanne Vega tape into the deck when her roommate walked in. Veronica was wearing a slinky white gown, along with a platinum wig and violet contacts.
Masquerade? Cordelia said. Just a date.
Veronica rolled her eyes.
It's a guy from Malta with a crush on both Marilyn Monroe and Liz Taylor.
She changed the subject.
Listen, any good tickets left for Saturday? At $2,500 a pop, I can't really comp you,
said Cordelia.
No problem. These are for management. Miranda and Ichiko can afford them. They just would like a little consideration about table placement. Close to the stage, okay? I'll see what I can do.
Cordelia jotted a note and put her book of things to do back in her handbag.
So how's work?
Said Veronica innocently. Cordelia told her.
Sounds like you could use a real detective. If I knew one, I'd ask. I'm desperate. Well,
said Veronica,
it just so happens maybe I can help you out. You want to tell me what you're talking about?
It would be so good, thought Cordelia, to turn this over to someone else.
Not yet,
Veronica said.
Let me work on it, and you can make sure those seats are good ones. Help me get Buddy Holly in front of the cameras,
said Cordelia,
and I'll let Miranda and Ichiko sit on stage behind the monitors. They can hold the microphones, anything their hearts desire. It's a deal.
Now then, continued Veronica,
before I go uptown, whose turn is it to buy cat food?
The men sat and listened to music and drank. Buddy Holly drank soda. Jack drank dark beer. Room service was accommodating. They talked. Every once in a while, Holly would get up to change the tapes. They went through Jimmy Rogers and Carl Perkins, Hank Williams and Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis Presley and Conway Twitty. Jack was surprised that the singer had some tapes of newer artists, Lyle Lovett and Dwight Yoakam and Steve Earle.
Like the monkey said, Holly said simply, you got to keep up with evolution.
They talked about the 50s, about Louisiana Bayou country and the dry vastness of West Texas.
Tell you, said Holly, it ain't saying much about Lubbock when about the only place to go on Saturday night is Amarillo. I went back there after the oil boom, and then again after the crash. Nothing much had changed either time.
No Buddy Holiday,
said Jack.
Figure I'll have to die before that happens.
They had a lot in common, Jack decided. Except there'd never be a Jack Robichaud day in Atelier Parish, not even after he'd died. He fumbled through the box of cassettes and held up one that was unlabeled, except for the word new.
What's this?
Oh, that's nothing, said Holly. Nothing you'd want to hear.
There was something about the way he'd protested, Jack thought. When Buddy Holly went into the bathroom, Jack set the mysterious cassette in the deck and punched play. The music was simple and unadorned. There was no backup, no double tracking, no layered sound. The singing was reflective in the first song, exuberant in the second. The lyrics were mature. The characteristic hiccup in the vocal line was there. This was Buddy Holly. Jack had never heard either of these songs before. He heard the bathroom door open behind him. Buddy Holly said,
after the plane went down with my family and Shrike bought all my music, people seemed to think I just wasn't going to write anymore. And for a few years, I guess I didn't.
The third song began.
All this is new, said Jack reverently. Is it not?
Buddy Holly's voice was soft and powerful.
Just as fresh as resurrection.
Tuesday. The funhouse was no Carnegie Hall, and as with virtually any other Manhattan club, daylight didn't become it. This morning the mirrors were streaked and dusty. They'd be polished to a high sheen by Saturday. As Jack looked across toward the stage, what he mostly saw were chairs stacked on tables. The few windows and skylights admitted bars of spring sunlight that contained myriad dancing dust motes. The place smelled stale. The other predominating odor was that of machine lubricant. Jack stood beside Buddy Holly. Holly stood beside CeCe Ryder. On the other side of CeCe was Vagabond. It was an unbreakable protocol. Vagabond had chosen to be CeCe's constant companion and protector. Jack realized he had consciously picked a similar role with Buddy Holly. He genuinely liked the singer, and it wasn't merely a matter of nostalgia for the 50s and 60s. He felt he was becoming genuine friends with the Texan. Though,
too bad,
whispered the nasty voice in his head.
You're not going to be buddies for very long.
Jack had seen Dr. Tachyon earlier in the morning. Tachyon had proposed hospitalizing him.
No way,
he'd said. Tachyon appealed to his reason.
Can you really predict what my version of the virus is going to do?
He'd asked. Tachyon admitted that he didn't truly know, but there were precautions. Jack had shrugged ruefully and left. Xavier Desmond, his elephantine trunk seeming to wilt down his chest, watched over the stage preparations. He moved slowly, in the manner of a man knowing the real proximity of death. Yet he seemed proud beyond words. For a night, the eyes of most of the world would be on his beloved funhouse. The limited space in the club was being further curtailed by the camera tracks laid in front of and to the side of the stage. The tech people had cleverly rigged a super-thin luma boom from the ceiling.
"Don't let it brush the chandelier,"
Des said as the remote operator put the mantis-like camera mount through its paces. Even with the shafts of sun glinting off the mirror balls, the club looked drab. Buddy Holly scratched his head.
"Shoot, I've seen worse stages."
C.C. laughed and said,
"I've played them."
"Guess there won't be no chicken wire around a stage, huh?"
C.C. shrugged and affected a deep, deep Texas accent.
"Joe Ely used to tell me about places so tough you had to puke 3 times and show a knife before they'd let you in. And that was if you was singing."
"Des runs a classier dive," said Jack. "I figure people laying out $2,500 a seat aren't going to heave Corona bottles at the band."
"Be more real if they did."
Holly glanced at CC.
"I gotta tell you, I'm pretty excited about hearing you sing."
"Same here," said CC. "Though I'm still edgy as a cat. You decided to go on for sure?"
Holly turned to Jack.
"Anything from your niece?"
Jack shook his head.
"I talked to her this morning. I guess things are going slow with Shrike, but she said no sweat, just bureaucratic runaround."
CC poked Holly in the ribs.
"Listen, man, I will if you will."
"The challenge?"
Holly slowly grinned.
"Think this'll be as much fun as racing for pink slips?" "What the hell? Okay, I'll go on first like the ghost of charts past, and if I have to, I'll cover, oh, Billy Idol."
"No,"
Vagabond spoke up.
"No, you won't."
Things weren't going terribly well for Cordelia. She had gotten into the office by 7. It was too bad about being so phased that she forgot about the sequence of time zones west. Little Stephen's road manager wasn't terribly happy about being awakened in his hotel room at a little past 4 in the morning. On the other hand, better news had come in about 10. X-rays had determined that the edge's fingers were mildly sprained rather than fractured. Even though U2's performance that night in Seattle was being scrubbed, the guitarist had a good shot at being operational by Saturday. Then there was the matter of Shrike music. Cordelia had a terrific flow chart with lines and arrows indicating the tangled skein owning the music publishing firm. She had lists of CEOs, presidents, vice presidents, and heads of promotion departments, and lawyers, Lord, hordes of attorneys. But no one would talk to her.
"How come?"
she wondered.
"Is it my breath?"
She giggled. Fatigue, she thought. Early burnout, way too soon. There would be time to collapse after Saturday night. She poured another cup of high-calf Colombian and started thinking seriously about Shrike and its masters, and why everyone was evading her as if she were a congressional investigator out bird-dogging payola charges. The phone beeped. Good. Maybe it was one of a dozen executives connected with Shrike or its Byzantine ownership returning her calls.
"Hi," said her roommate. "You got the tickets for me? Have you lined up Spencer, or maybe Sam Spade?" "Even better," said Veronica. "Got somebody here I want you to talk to."
"Veronica,"
she started to say. Why was everyone playing cloak and dagger?
"This is Croyd," said an unfamiliar male voice. "You met me. We had a little date. You, me, and Veronica.
I remember,
said Cordelia.
But...
I'm in investigations. Flatly.
I guess I knew that, but I didn't think...
Just listen, said Croyd. This is Veronica's idea, not mine. Maybe I can help, maybe not. You want to know something about Shrike music?
Right. Buddy Holly and I need to find out who really owns his music so I can get permission for him to sing it, and I can convince him to appear Saturday.
So isn't Shrike in the phone book? Said Croyd.
They've been stonewalling me like they were the mafia or something.
She heard a dry chuckle. Maybe they are.
Anything you can do,
Cordelia said.
I'll be very...
Croyd broke in again. I'll see what I can find out. I'll get back to you. The connection clicked off. Cordelia set the phone down and allowed herself a smile. She crossed her fingers, both hands. Then she picked up from the desk the next note begging her attention. This one was simpler. Maybe she could find out in less than an hour exactly why girls with guns seemed to be hung up in Cleveland. Wednesday. GF&G had decided that the Funhouse Club band would back both CC Rider and Buddy Holly. Actually, it was CC who approved them. GF&G paid the checks.
They're all sound musicians, said CC to Holly.
Good enough for me. He watched and listened as the two guitarists, drummer, keyboard woman, and sax player tuned. Jack observed, too. Practice would be long and tedious. But if you were an observer, it was show business in action. It was diverting, glamorous. It was heaven. CC led Holly onto the stage. Vagabond sat down at a front table, though the action looked performed under duress. Jack knew that she really did want to follow CC on up there.
Mind if I sit here? He said to her, setting his hand on the back of the chair opposite.
Vagabond's dark eyes fixed on him fiercely for just a split second. She shrugged slightly, and Jack sat.
Okay, CC was saying to the musicians on the stage. Here's what I'm going to want to start with, or maybe end with, damned if I know yet. All I really know is that it's new, and it's part of my 20 minutes.
She jacked in her ebony 12-string and strummed a chord progression.
We got a whole 3 days to get in tune, so remember the advantage we have over dudes like the boss or you too.
Everybody grinned.
Okay, let's do it. This is called Baby You've Been Dealt a Winning Hand. 1, 2, 3, and...
The moment CC started to play, she looked stricken. Nervous, Jack thought, was too mild a word for it. There was no crowd. There was no audience, save the musicians, the technicians working on sound and lights, and the few odd observers such as Jack and Vagabond. CC's lead went hideously flat. She stopped, looked down at the stage while everyone in the club seemed to hold a collective breath. Then CC looked up, and to Jack it seemed the motion was executed with enormous effort. Her fingers caressed the strings of her guitar.
Sorry,
she said. That was all. And then she played. Baby, the cards are out. Baby, there is no doubt that when the dealer calls, you've been dealt a winning hand. The drummer picked up the backbeat. The bass player chugged in. The rhythm guitar softly filled the spaces. Jack saw Buddy Holly's fingers lightly stroking the strings of his Telecaster, even though it wasn't jacked in. You played since you were just a kid. You played till you got old. Baby, you never knew a thing, 'cause all you ever did was fold. The woman on keyboards ran an eerie, wailing trill out of her Yamaha. Jack blinked. Holly smiled. It sounded like the rinky-tink Farfisas both remembered from the pre-synthesizer good old days. Baby, don't ever fold, not when you got that winning hand. When it was done, there were a long few moments of absolute silence in the funhouse. Then the tech people started to clap. So did CC's backup musicians. They cheered. Vagabond got to her feet. Jack saw Xavier Desmond in the back of the room. It looked as if there were tears on his face. Buddy Holly scratched his head and grinned. A little like Will Rogers, Jack thought.
You know something, darling?
I think maybe all of us here were privileged this morning to see the high point of the concert.
Cece looked pale, but she smiled and said,
No, it's pretty rough. It's only going to get better.
Holly shook his head. Cece Ryder marched over to him and tilted her face up toward his.
You're turning the barrel, boyo.
The man shook his head, but his fingers were caressing the guitar. Cece tapped the side of her head.
I showed you mine.
Holly made a little shrug.
What the heck? Gotta do it sometime, I reckon.
No Billy Idol,
Vagabond said. Holly laughed.
No Billy Idol.
He strummed contemplatively for a moment. Then he said,
This is new.
He glanced over at Jack.
This one ain't even on the tape you heard.
The strum deepened, picked up strength.
I call this one Rough Beast.
Then Buddy Holly played.
It was incredible, Cordy. It's the old Buddy Holly with all the maturity laid in.
Jack's voice was exuberant and uncritical.
Everything he played was new, and it was absolutely great.
New, huh?
Cordelia tapped the earpiece with her right index finger.
As good as That'll Be the Day and Oh Boy?
Is Maxwell Silverhammer better than I Want to Hold Your Hand?
The excitement crackled in Jack's voice.
It isn't even apples and oranges. The new stuff's as energetic as his early songs. It's just more.
Jack seemed to be searching for the precise word.
Sophisticated.
Cordelia stared at the photographs across the office, but wasn't seeing them. Click.
There might as well be a light bulb switching on above my head,
she thought.
I've got to slow down. I'm starting to miss a lot. What I'm guessing,
she said,
is that Shrike doesn't have any claim on the new stuff. What I can do is put him in the hammock in the middle of the show, maybe cut him down to 10 minutes.
20, said Jack firmly. It has to be as much as everyone else.
Maybe,
said Cordelia.
Anyhow, he's in the center, so the audience warms up before they have to decide whether they're going to be disappointed when Buddy Holly don't sing Cindy Lou.
There was a silence on the line. Jack finally said,
I don't think he'll mind.
Okay, then. Great. This is really going to simplify matters. I can tell the wet brains at Shrike to screw off.
Cordelia felt the crushing weight start to lift from her head.
You sure he'll do the show with new material?
Jack's words were a verbal shrug.
The ice do seem to be broken. He and CC are reinforcing each other. I think it's all going to work out.
Great. Thanks, Uncle Jack. Keep me current.
Cordelia's mood was cheerful after she hung up the phone. So Buddy Holly was in. And now she could call Croyd off the wild goose chase. But when she phoned the apartment, no one answered. All she reached was the answering machine.
Maybe,
she thought cheerfully,
it's all going to be downhill from here.
Thursday. Cordelia realized she was humming Real Wild Child. The up-tempo rocker perfectly matched her hyper mood this afternoon. She wondered for a moment where she'd heard it as she identified the tune. She knew it was on none of her Buddy Holly albums. The song must just be in the air. She tapped along with her fingers to the guitar runs in her head as she dialed her post-lunch calls. Cordelia had phoned over to the funhouse just about the time her takeout Vietnamese soup had arrived. Jack was sounding up.
Practice is going great, he had said. CC and Buddy are getting along fine, and Vagabond even nodded to me when I said good morning.
How's the music?
They're both doing mostly new stuff. Well, Buddy's is all new.
Can he fill the whole 20 minutes?
Cordelia had said.
Just like before, when I said he wouldn't have any problem, he still won't. You really ought to give him an hour.
I'm not sure how you two or the boss would like that,
Cordelia said dryly.
I bet they'd love it.
We won't be finding out.
Cordelia sniffed the fragrance of crab and asparagus wafting out of the styrofoam soup bucket.
I've got to go, Uncle Jack. My food's here.
Okay.
Jack's voice hesitated.
Cordy.
Oomph.
She already had the first spoonful in her mouth.
Thanks for asking me to do this. It's a terrific thing. I'm grateful. It's keeping my mind off everything else going on in the world.
Cordelia swallowed the hot soup.
Just go on keeping Cece and Buddy Holly happy. And Vagabond, too, if it's possible.
I'll try.
About 2 o'clock, Cordelia was dialing the contract firm that was trying to exorcise the demons from Showsat 3 when, out of the corner of her eye, she caught an unfamiliar figure silhouetted in the office doorway. Setting down the phone, she saw a distinguished-looking middle-aged man dressed in a cream silk suit that she knew had to be worth 2 or 3 months of her salary. Tailored to the final Angstrom unit. Knotted foulard precisely positioned. Head cocked, he regarded her with sharp eyes.
"You're too well-dressed to be Tom Wolfe,"
she said.
"Indeed I am not. Tom Wolfe, that is."
He didn't smile.
"Do you mind if I come in and chat with you?"
"Did we have an appointment?"
Cordelia said puzzledly. She glanced down at her calendar.
"I'm afraid I don't..."
"I was in the neighborhood," said the man. "We have an appointment. It's just I'm afraid you were not informed."
He extended one hand.
"Forgive the lack of formal introduction. I'm St. John Latham, at your service. I represent Latham Strauss. I expect you've heard of us."
Cordelia caught a gleam of intensely manicured nails as she grasped his hand. His grip was dry and perfunctory.
"The attorneys,"
she said.
Yes, please do sit down."
He took the guest chair. As a backdrop for Latham's suit, the brewer looked a mite shabby.
"Let me get to the point, Miss Chasson. Or may I call you Cordelia?"
"If you wish."
Cordelia tried to gather her thoughts. For the senior partner of one of Manhattan's priciest and nastiest law firms to be sitting in her office just might not be a good omen.
"Now," said Latham, his fingers steepled, the index fingers just brushing his thin chin, "I'm informed you have been causing considerable commotion with a number of Latham Strauss's client corporations. As you doubtless discovered, we are retained by the Carabank Group, and thus have an interest in their respective subsidiary holdings."
"I'm not sure I see."
"You have obviously been rather inventive with your computer and modem, Cordelia. You've not been terribly discreet with your calls to a variety of corporate officials."
It was suddenly coming very clear.
"Oh,"
said Cordelia.
"This is about Shrike Music and Buddy Holly, right?"
Latham's tone was even, and functioned at about the same temperature as a superconductor.
"You seem to have an extreme interest in Carabank's corporate family."
Cordelia smiled and held up her hands.
"Hey, no problem, Mr. Latham. It's not my hassle any longer. Holly's got a whole collection of new music that Shrike can't touch."
"Miss Chasson, Cordelia, Shrike Music Corporation is the least consequential of your enquiries. We at Latham Strauss are concerned about your apparent need for information about the rest of Carabank's family. Such information could be a bit troublesome."
"No, really,"
said Cordelia decisively.
"This is a non-problem. Honest, Mr. Latham, no problem."
She smiled at him.
"Now, if you don't mind, I've got an incredible amount of work to catch."
Latham stared at her.
"You will desist, Miss Chasson. You will pay attention to your own business, or I assure you, you shall be very, very sorry."
"But..."
"Very sorry indeed."
Latham looked at her levelly until she finally blinked.
"I hope you understand me."
He turned on his heel and exited with a whisper of expensive tailoring. It hit her.
"Hang me with Cordebayo,"
she thought.
"I've just been threatened by one of Manhattan's most powerful and predatory attorneys, so sue me."
Cordelia had plenty to do that helped take her mind away from Latham's visit. She called the tech people in charge of satellite transmissions and discovered the happy fact that Showsat 3 was operational again. A healthy chunk of the other side of the world would have a shot at viewing the Funhouse benefit after all.
"I guess the gremlins are on vacation," said the consulting engineer.
Then GF&G's switchboard relayed a collect call from Tammy in Pittsburgh.
What on earth are you doing there?
Cordelia demanded.
I sent enough cash so all the girls with guns could fly into Newark today. You're not going to believe this,
said Tammy.
Probably not. We bought a lot of feathers. Not coke? Of course not,
Tammy sounded scandalized.
We ran into a girl who had an incredible selection. We need them for our costumes Saturday night. Feathers don't cost $600. These do. They're rare. Those feathers going to help you fly?
Cordelia said dangerously.
Well, no,
said Tammy.
I'll wire some more money. Just give me an address.
Cordelia sighed.
So, you ladies enjoy riding the bus?
Friday. Jack and Buddy Holly headed back to the latter's dressing room after they'd both watched the boss do his run-through. Holly's final rehearsal session was scheduled for 10 o'clock later that night. Little Stephen, U2, and the Coward Brothers had gotten in their licks early in the afternoon. The Edge had winced a lot, but he'd played. Then came the boss and the other guys from across the river.
Not too shabby, said Holly.
The boss, said Jack. Damn straight. So how did it feel, him treating you as though you were one of the faces on Mount Rushmore come to life?
Shoot.
Holly said nothing more.
I thought it was pretty impressive when he asked if you'd play Cindy Lou.
Holly chuckled.
Funny thing about that tune. You know it almost wasn't going to be Cindy Lou.
Jack looked at him quizzically. They rounded the corner of the hallway behind the stage. The lighting was something less than adequate.
Watch out for the wire on the floor, said Holly. Good old Cindy Lou. Well, that was the original title all along, but about the time the Crickets and me were going to record it, our drummer, Jerry Allison, asked if I'd change it.
Change the music? Said Jack.
Change the title. Seems as if Jerry was marrying a gal named Peggy Sue, and he thought she'd just be tickled to death having a song named after her.
But you didn't.
Holly laughed.
She jilted him, broke the engagement before anything permanent could be done about the song, so Cindy Lou, it stayed.
I like it better, said Jack.
They turned a final corner and came to the small room where Holly was keeping his guitar and the other things he'd brought over from the hotel. Holly went in first. When he flipped the light switch, nothing happened.
Blamed bulb must be out.
Not quite, said a voice from inside.
Both Jack and Holly jumped.
Who's in there?
Said Jack. Holly started to back out of the doorway.
Hold it, said the voice.
Everything's fine, as long as you two are Buddy Holly and Jack Robichaux.
You got that right, said Holly.
The name's Croyd.
Holly said, I don't know any Croyd.
I do, said Jack. I mean, I know who you are.
The voice chuckled.
I'm in a bit of a hurry, and I'm trying to be subtle. So why not the two of you come on in and shut the door?
The two men did so. Croyd snapped on a pen light and let the beam play briefly across their faces.
Okay, you're who you say.
He set the light down on the makeup table but didn't turn it off.
I've got some information for your niece,
he said to Jack,
but her office doesn't know where she is and I don't have time to wait around on her.
Okay, said Jack. Tell me, I'll get it to her. She's jumping around like a frog in a tub of McElhenney's, what with about 10,000 things to get done before tomorrow night.
She asked me to look into Shrike Music, said Croyd.
Oh, yeah?
Holly sounded interested.
I thought it might be one of the Gambione fronts, you know, a mafia laundering operation. So, said Jack, are Rosemary Muldoon's hands dirty there, too?
No, said Croyd. I don't think so. Whatever Shrike is, and I think it's dirty as hell, I really don't think it's connected with the Gambionis or the other families. Tell Cordelia Chasson that.
Anything else? Said Jack.
Yeah. As far as I could follow the trail back, I got some hints that the brain behind Shrike is Loophole. You know, the lawyer, St. John Latham. If I'm right, you better tell your niece to be real careful. With Loophole, I'm talking one dangerous son of a bitch.
Okay, Jack said. I'll tell her.
If you find out more, Holly said.
I won't,
I've got my own problems to deal with.
Croyd's chuckle was very dry.
Oh, said Holly. Well, thanks anyhow. At least I know my songs aren't tied up in pasta.
Listen, said Croyd, some animation coming into his voice. Shake, Rattle, and Roll is one of the best rockers ever recorded. Don't let anyone ever tell you different. I just wanted to say that before I took off.
Well, said Holly. Thank you very much. He strode forward in the darkness toward the makeup table. I'll shake the hand of any man who tells me that.
What can I say? Said Croyd. I've liked your work for a long time now. Glad you're back.
Jack had the impression of a pale albino face in the dark. Pink eyes flashed as the penlight snapped off.
Good luck with the concert.
Then Croyd's indistinct form was out the door and gone.
Okay, said Jack. Let's see if we can round up a fresh light bulb.
He winced. The pain was coming back. The pain and something else. In the darkness, he touched his own face. The skin felt scaly. The virus was eroding his control. It was getting harder to remain. He didn't like filling in the blank. Human was the word he was looking for. Saturday. The audio ocean combers of U2 crashed over them. The edges picking fingers had healed just fine for tonight. Bono swung into With or Without You with his exuberant never sing the song the same way twice voice in great form. CC abruptly stared at Buddy Holly with concern. She reached out to steady him. Jack moved in from the other side.
What's wrong, babe?
She touched his forehead with the back of her right hand.
You're burning up.
Vagabond looked concerned.
You need a doc?
The four of them stepped back as a cameraman with a Steadicam double-timed by, heading for the stage. Holly straightened.
It's okay. I'm all right. Just a little flop sweat. You sure?
Said CC skeptically.
I guess, said Holly. Maybe I was feeling some momentary melancholy.
His three companions registered uniform incomprehension.
Waiting to go on out there. It's getting to me in a strange way. I'm looking at all this and I'm thinking about Richie and the bopper and how they both went down with Bobby Fuller in that beach craft back in 68 when Bobby was trying his comeback tour. Lord, I do miss him.
You're alive,
said Vagabond.
They're not.
Holly stared at her. Then he slowly smiled.
That's putting it straight.
He looked past the curtains toward the full house.
Yep, I'm alive.
You go and sit down for a bit, said Jack. Rest just a while.
Remind me, said Holly. When do I go on?
The Coward Brothers are on next, then little Stephen and me, said CC. I'll warm them up for you. You'll be up before Girls with Guns and the Boss.
Comfortable in the hammock, huh? Heavy hitter company.
Holly shook his head.
You know how the world would change if somebody nuked this club tonight? Not a bit.
He staggered.
Well, maybe just a little bitty bit.
You're gonna sit down, said CC firmly.
Jack looked toward the stage. This was probably the only rock concert he'd been to that wasn't choked with smoke. But in the confined space of the funhouse, the management, the health department, and some of the performers had begged for abstinence. The tech crew was using a fog machine to get the right lighting. With the lights in his face, Jack could see nothing. But he knew who was out there. Cordelia was sitting next to the small, roped-off space where the floor director was sequestered with her video monitors. Everything looked good. The satellite feeds were webbing the globe satisfactorily, though God only knew if any eyes out there were actually watching. Every seat was taken. People had paid $2,000 just for standing room. Cordelia had checked around her chair before U2 had been announced. The table immediately behind her was occupied by New Jersey's junior U.S. senator, the senator's wife, Hoboken's head of cultural development, a hot teen heartthrob actor, and the actor's ICM agent. The next table to the left held Senator Hartman and his party. Tachyon was back there, too. a beaming Xavier Desmond was right up front. Off to her right, Miranda and Ichiko had seen her looking and had waved and smiled. Cordelia had smiled back. Luz Alcala and Polly Reddick, GF&G's top management, also sat at Cordelia's table. Now and then they said appropriately laudatory things to her. Obviously they were enjoying how the benefit concert was progressing.
Baffo,
thought Cordelia.
That's how Variety will describe this. They better damn better.
U2 ended its set and the Irish quartet trooped off stage. The applause thundered on and they came back for a quick encore. That had been budgeted into the schedule, it was assumed. After the encore, the screen dropped down from the funhouse's ceiling, barely missing the Luma crane, and the slick, donated media spot for the New York AIDS Project blazed forth. This was the commercial. No one minded. Cordelia wondered if she should go backstage and check that all was in order. No, she decided. She needed to be in place where she was, waiting for hideous crises. No use seeking them out. The Coward Brothers came out to a storm of applause. T-Bone and Elvis burned the place up with People's Limousine and another 16 minutes that flashed by like no time at all. Between sets, when the broadcast had gone to a taped message, the lighting director turned the spots on the funhouse's mirror balls and chandelier. The interior of the club exploded in a phantasmagoria of shattered light. Little Steven and his band came on. The roadies had been fast and accurate. The musicians plugged into the house system and were off. Little Steven had a new scarf for each song in the set. The crowd loved it. It was CC Ryder's time. She held the neck of her shining black 12-string with both hands. "Don't strangle it," said Holly. He wrapped his hands loosely around hers.
"Break a leg."
Jack gave her a hug. Vagabond didn't seem to mind. The latter hugged CC in turn for a few seconds and said,
"You'll be great." "If I'm not," said CC, "I hope this time I'm an express."
Jack knew she was referring to her years ago wild card transformation when trauma had catalyzed her into becoming a more than reasonable facsimile of a local subway car. CC hit the stage running and never stopped. It was as though she was casting a net of power over the audience. There was a moment at first when she faltered, but then she seemed to gather strength. It was as though energy were flowing out into the people in their seats, then being amplified and broadcast back to the singer. The magic, Jack thought, of genuine empathy. She started with one of her old standards, then quickly segued into her new ballads. Her 20 minutes flashed past for Jack. CC ended with the song she had publicly debuted at the first rehearsal. "Baby, you never have to fold, 'cause what you've got is a winning hand." "Is a winning hand," came the refrain. "Never forget." CC bowed her head. The applause had mega tonnage. When she came off stage, she waited until she was past the curtains before collapsing. Jack and Vagabond both caught her.
"What's the matter?"
said Vagabond.
"Oh, CC." "Nothing,"
said CC. She grinned up at them, her face lined with exhaustion.
"Absolutely nothing." "Okay,"
Cordelia muttered as the Jokertown Clinic spot unspooled above her.
"Buddy Holly's next."
In spite of what Uncle Jack said, she wondered if she should cross her fingers, maybe toes too.
"Hold on a sec,"
said the floor director. She leaned toward Cordelia.
"Change in plans."
"Shit," thought Cordelia.
"What?" "Seems to be a minor rebellion among the musicians. It's still getting sorted out." "Better be quick."
Cordelia glanced at the LED counting down on the director's console.
"Like in about 22 seconds.
"But I'm supposed to go on now," said Buddy Holly stubbornly. "The deal is," said Jack, "both the boss and Girls with Guns have decided they want to go now and let you be the final act."
Vagabond glanced beyond them.
"The boss and that girl Tammy are arm wrestling. Looks like she's winning."
"But it's my gig," said Holly.
"Shut the fuck up,"
said the Girls with Guns leader, Tammy, as she strutted up, rubbing her right shoulder. She uttered the words with considerable affection.
Him and I,
she gestured at the boss, who was ruefully grinning.
We both figure we learned most all we know from you, so you're going to be the climax. That's it, bud.
She leaned up on tiptoes and kissed him on the lips. Holly looked startled. The stage director was signaling frantically. The glass eyes of the Steadicams implacably zoomed in. Girls with Guns upped the energy ante by tearing out the heart of Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart's bubblegum standard, I Wonder What She's Doing Tonight, stomping it into jam, smearing the residue on their sneering lips, and just generally raising hell. They ended up with Proud Flesh, a razor-edged anthem of romance and nihilism. So, said Tammy to the boss as she led her sisters swaggering off stage,
top that.
The boss did his best.
Oh, God,
thought Cordelia as the echoes finally died. She watched the boss raise his guitar in one hand and elevate a fist with the other.
Let Buddy work out, please.
The boss gave the audience another bow, then led his band backstage. Cordelia blinked. She thought she'd seen St. John Latham at a table in the back of the club.
Latham Strauss's cash is as good as anyone else's, she thought.
The problem was, Latham seemed to be staring directly at her. She sighed as the penultimate PSA faded to black and the director cued in the Luma. The monitor showed a wide tracking shot sweeping back and up from the stage.
And go,
said the director into her mic.
Please,
Cordelia again mentally implored.
Hello, Lubbock,
Buddy Holly said to the immediate audience and their 500 million electronic shadows. The crowd smiled. Jack smiled too from his vantage at the edge of the stage. He crouched down to avoid getting in the way of the camera dollying past on its track. The pain was gnawing regularly at his gut, and he didn't know how long he'd be able to hold this position. He realized that what he wanted now more than anything else was simply to lie down. He wanted to rest.
Soon enough, he thought morbidly. I'll rest all I want. For good.
Holly hit his first note, then brushed his fingers across the chord. The magic Buddy Holly touch. Now it might be a standard technique, but 3 decades before, it had signaled a revolution.
Ruff beast.
The characteristic hiccup was still there, though no one in the paying audience had ever heard this Buddy Holly tune before. When the moon slides low and love rubs thin, I'll be knocking, asking to be let in. To Jack, it seemed a little like vintage Dylan, maybe a dash of Lou Reed. But most of it was just pure Holly.
Ruff beast,
almost a wail. Jack realized he could easily cry. When my friends, like my center, cannot hold, and every feeling I got has just been sold. He was crying. I'm the rough beast's prey, in the rough beast's way. Buddy Holly's Telecaster sobbed, not in self-pity, but in honest grief. Without friends, without love, forever. Jack loved the music, but the pain was horrendous. When he could no longer withstand it, he got up and quietly left. He missed the encore. Cordelia was already looking ahead to the final extravagant encore when every performer would come onto the stage and all would stand there with hands and arms linked. She blinked and registered a double take as she realized Buddy Holly looked about ready to fall flat on his face as he stood there taking the applause from his final song. She was close enough that she could see the flush in his face. Holly staggered.
Oh, Jesus,
she thought.
He's sick. He's going to collapse.
But he didn't. It was as though the flush in his skin metamorphosed into a ripple of heat that ran along his body from feet to head.
What the hell?
Thought Cordelia. Then it was Buddy Holly's flesh itself that rippled. A transforming nimbus of energy seemed to glow around his body. He held the Fender Telecaster out in front of him, and something astonishing happened. The steel strings became ductile, melting like taffy,
flashing away from the frets, stretching out and out like lines of silver sparks. They whipped around camera mounts and lights, anchoring themselves like jungle snakes.
Illusion?
Cordelia thought. Maybe it was telekinesis. The guitar strings formed a kind of enormous cat's cradle. Buddy Holly looked around at this, then at his hands. He slowly raised his head and gazed upward. Holly seemed to be seeing something nobody else could comprehend. He smiled, and the smile transformed into a joyous grin. And then he danced. Slow and deliberate at first, the pace grew more rapid as Holly began to whirl around the stage. The audience stared, gaping. She had seen this dance before, or something like it. Cordelia recalled the memory. Wayungari. She had seen the young Aboriginal man dance in this manner deep within the dreamtime, far into the desert heartland of Australia. This was a shaman's dance. Holly's grin widened. He leaped and gyrated. Screamin' Jay Hawkins and James Brown could have done no better. Then Holly leaped into the shimmering, almost invisible web work of silver sparks. He whirled and his right hand came off, severed at the wrist with a gush of crimson smoke. Someone in the audience gasped. Holly continued to dance. The other hand, the right arm up to the elbow, his left leg at the knee. Scarlet smoke fanned out like the curving trails of fire from a Catherine wheel. Cordelia became aware the director was addressing her.
Should we go to a spot?
The director's voice was taut. It was all coming clear to Cordelia.
No,
she said.
No, leave it. Broadcast everything.
Buddy Holly whirled within the cradle of sparking tracers. He disassembled himself as the audience murmured and cried out. From the chair beside her at the table, Cordelia heard Polly Reddick say,
God almighty, it's just like with Kid Dinosaur. No,
Cordelia said aloud.
It's not. It's the Death and Resurrection show. It's just a joke. It's entertainment. Entertainment, said Reddick. He's killing himself. I don't think so, said Cordelia. He's transforming, but he's not dying. This is a shaman's trick.
The last of Buddy Holly, a nearly limbless torso, wavered and tumbled to the stage. The body parts lay stacked in a haphazard heap. Curtains of bright smoke rose up. Sparks shot up in fountaining streamers. The audience watched, uncertain how to react. Cordelia felt calm and sure. She trusted Wayungari. She wondered if Holly's transmogrification was a direct result of the wildcard virus. That would explain his apparent illness. The pile of arms and legs stirred. The bones began to reconnect, joint to joint. The muscles and ligaments wound around them. The skin slithered onto the limbs, and the limbs rejoined the body. Buddy Holly stood before them, whole again. He wasn't completely the physical original. This Buddy Holly was fitter, the spare tire around his waist and the bags under the eyes gone. His hair was a glossy black again, with no gray. His skin was smooth and unwrinkled. The crowd began to clap. The cheering rose as the audience's collective tension released. Someone behind Cordelia said,
That's the absolute fucking performance of a lifetime.
The guitar had also reassembled. Holly picked up the Telecaster and held it loosely.
He got what he wanted,
Cordelia thought.
He's become a shaman,
she said aloud.
Buddy Holly and the Shamans, said a voice behind her.
Bitchin' name. After this, it'd sell like Fawn Hall's underwear. Man, this Holly could become a presidential candidate.
Cordelia turned and saw it was the ICM man who had spoken. She gave him a frigid stare and turned back toward the stage. The new being that had been Buddy Holly smiled reassuringly. Then he brought his hand across the guitar strings. The chord throbbed as though resonating with every heart in the audience.
The sound,
thought Cordelia.
It's a trigger for states of heightened consciousness. This is the power of rock and roll.
Then, Buddy Holly, the reborn man of power, stood before the awestruck audience and played the best version of Not Fade Away that had ever been performed. It was, Cordelia suspected, a portent. As Jack slipped away from the alley door of the funhouse, he felt sick in heart and body.
I should have stayed for Buddy's encore,
he thought, but Buddy would do just fine. There was the scraping on asphalt of something inhumanly large shifting its weight. Jack stopped abruptly as a shadow deeper than the darkness in the rest of the alley fell across him.
I figured a blue ribbon fag party like this would draw all my little buddies, said Bludgeon. But I didn't even hope the first fucker would be you.
Without warning, his deformed right hand whistled out, catching Jack across the head and slamming him back into the brick side of a building. Jack felt something give, bone or cartilage, he couldn't tell. All he knew was that he was slipping away from what light there was. He wanted the darkness, but not yet, not this way. He tried to struggle. He was aware that Bludgeon was grasping him tightly and holding him upright. Bludgeon jerked loose Jack's belt and pulled down his pants.
Got a little going-away thing for you, Jack. Something I figure you'll love. I bet your niece Cordelia'll eat it up when I get around to her, too.
Jack tried to will himself back into full consciousness. Then he felt what Bludgeon was shoving between his buttocks, into him, spreading and tearing. Nothing had ever hurt this much. Nothing.
I'll save the little girl for later, said Bludgeon.
Jesus, thought Jack through the agony.
Cordelia! Let her alone, you rat-bastard cochon!
Sticks and stones, said Bludgeon, emitting a high-pitched giggle. But only the fat man can hurt me.
He thrust forward and Jack screamed.
Where was the other? Jack thought desperately, his brain seeming to heel over in a grinding haze of pain. I need you. Now I've got to transform. This once. Just to kill the son of a bitch.
And then he felt the change coming. He also knew he was dying.
Good,
he thought.
Good to both.
And a surprise for Bludgeon. Jack felt the teeth springing up as his jaw elongated.
Pestilence or claw, you son of a bitch, you're gonna die.
The fierce anger carried him a little further.
Vagabond,
his thought shouted into the night.
Hear me. Save Cordelia.
I'll save the little girl for later,
Bludgeon's threat echoed. It all rippled into a void and died. The dead man plunged into darkness.